I've been reading from the third canto, Srimad Bhagavatam, and this evening we'll be reading from Canto 3, Chapter 3, Text 20. Chapter 3 is entitled The Lord's Pastimes Out of Vrindavan. This is Uddhava speaking to Vidura. Those of you that are familiar with Canto 1, you know that Vidura left home, beginning of chapter 13 of Canto 1. Vidura is insulted by Duryodhana, and he leaves and goes on pilgrimage. And then he comes back to deliver Dhritarashtra. So the beginning of the third canto, the sages ask Sunta the details. When Vidura left home, where did he go? And he met Maitreya. That must have been a wonderful conversation. Vidura is so elevated and Maitreya is so perfect. They must have had wonderful discussions. What did they discuss? What topics? So he's milking the cow with the milking tongue. And the sages get to hear from Suta Goswami about the conversations that where Vidura traveled, and then his finding Uddhava in a forest by the bank of the river Jamuna, just after Uddhava has heard Uddhava Gita, which comes in the 11th canto. So you can see, the Bhagavatam is not chronological, but it's very logical. Because it's giving Uddhava's outburst of emotion, of separation from Krishna. But then in his separation from Krishna, he's remembering Krishna. And as he's remembering Krishna, he's feeling more intensely his love for Krishna, which intensifies his separation from Krishna. That's amazing. So he begins with his emotional outburst of how unfortunate, like transcendental emotional outburst of how unfortunate we all are that Krishna's gone. And then he starts describing Krishna's pastimes chronologically, mostly chronologically, from Vrindavan in chapter 2. Then, once he leaves Vrindavan, chapter 3. And he's been describing Krishna's marriages, you know, the Swayamvara ceremony and the kidnapping of Rukmini and this and that. The 16,100 princesses that were captured by terrible demon. He killed Mura and then killed Narakasura, and then accepted in marriage the 16,100 queens. So now he has his queens, 16,108. And it's described next as the dissolution of the Yadu dynasty at Prabhas Kshetra. And then after Krishna's departure, after that, the annihilation of the Yadu dynasty, he goes back to Maharaj Parikshit being saved in the womb of Uttara, and the Pandavas, Dharmaraj, that's the son of Yamaraj, Yudhisthira, performs his three Ashvamedha yagyas, all under Krishna's arrangement. And then he's describing Krishna's life in Dwarka. So the immediate previous verse is Simultaneously, so Yudhisthira is installed in Mathura, and he's ruling in Mathura city with full devotion unto Krishna. Constantly absorbed in thought of Krishna. Meanwhile, Krishna is in Dwarka, enjoying life in the city of Dwarka, strictly in conformity with the Vedic customs of society. He was situated in detachment and knowledge, as enunciated by the Samkhya system of philosophy. So, the emphasis here is, he's God. So he is perfect in philosophy. He's not only, like, you know, he learned it, but he's the source of it. So he's situated in perfect knowledge, and therefore he's situated in perfect detachment. Logical. If a conditioned soul, by being situated in knowledge, can become strengthened in detachment, then what to speak of he was the source of all knowledge. He is perfect in detachment. As a true follower of the Sankhya philosophy, which he is the propounder of. So then text 20, which is our verse for this evening. He was there in his transcendental body, the residence of a goddess of fortune, with his usual gentle and sweetly smiling face, his nectarian words, and his flawless character. All of these are meditations. Each one of the verses, and so we'll go slowly. Uddhava is not an ordinary devotee. Uddhava is just even thinking of talking about Krishna. He lost it. He went into a trance, an ecstatic trance. Just thinking of talking about Krishna. It's described earlier, previous chapter. He lost external consciousness. He was with Krishna in the spiritual world. Tears were streaming from his eyes, his hairs were standing on his end, his limbs were trembling. He couldn't speak, his voice was choked up. The symptoms of ecstatic bhava was out of control, and he was trying to come back to external consciousness in order he could serve Vidura. But he couldn't. And finally he came to external consciousness and began to speak. That's the, like, state of Uddhava. And he's terribly pained because Krishna has left. And his life is Krishna. It's like living when you lost your life. What's that? He's somehow living. Krishna is his life. Krishna's gone. So he's in this, the question asked by Vidura is, in one sense, saving his life, because he's able to think of Krishna and speak about Krishna. So as he's speaking about Krishna, bear in mind, it's like he's in a state of ecstasy. He's not a sadhaka. He's not even bhava bhakti, he's prema bhakti. And his speaking about Krishna is very nice. So he's just described Krishna's life in Dwarka, and Krishna's life in Dwarka, he's detached and situated in knowledge. But at the same time, in this verse, it's saying he is on his transcendental body is situated the goddess of fortune. his transcendental body is the residence of the goddess of fortune. I'll read Prabhupada's purport. In the previous verse, it is described the Lord Krishna being situated in the truths of Samkhya philosophy is detached from all kinds of matter, which is true. In the present verse, it is described that he is the residence of the goddess of fortune. These two things are not at all contradictory. Lord Krishna is detached from the variegatedness of the inferior nature, but he is in eternal, blissful enjoyment of a spiritual nature, or his internal potency. Now, this is not a living entity. This is Krishna. In Bhagavad Gita, in the Bhagavad Gita, the internal potency is described as para prakriti. Who knows that verse from Bhagavad Gita? Living entity, chapter 7. Living entity is described as para prakriti. There's two verses in a row. One, Krishna is describing his external energy, and then he's describing his living entity. And he says, I'm the controller of both, because prakriti is controlled by Purusha. So, Pumirapona loba yukamano bhutir eva cha ankar iti me dina prakriti ashtada. That's the material elements. Aparayamitasvayam prakritim vidhi me param. Prakritim vidhi me param. Vidhi, know this to be my para prakriti. Jiva bhuta mahabaho. Living entities are Krishna's para prakriti, stated in Bhagavad Gita. Then Prabhupada goes to Padma Purana. In Padma Purana, there's a nice verse where the living entity is called Parashakti. Same thing, para prakriti, Parashakti. How does the verse go? Vishnu Shakti para prokta. That's the first line. There's three. Vishnu Shakti para prokta. The energy of the personality God is para. Supreme. Transcendental. And then then become the living entity. Kshetragya cha tata para. What's Kshetragya? Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13. Kshetragya is the knower of the field of activities. Kshetragya cha tata para. The living entity is also para, tata para, as this, so this. So, Vishnu Shakti, para, prokta, kshetragya cha, tata para. Living entity is also spiritual. Avidya karma, samgyaya. What's avidya karma? Matters, material activity. Now, activity and ignorance. Avidya karma. Samgyaya. Tritiya shaktir ishate. The third energy is this one. Avidya karma samgyaya tritiya shaktir. So we have three energies. Superior, marginal, and inferior. Right? Or commonly we say superior, inferior, and marginal. Those are the three energies. So that's Padma Purana. And who is Krishna? He's the predominator of the prakriti. is not avidya karma, samgaya, tritiya, shaktir. Avidya karma. Kshetragya Chattatapara. He's the Supreme Personality of Godhead who is, he knows all fields of activity. He's the controller of all of his energies. So now, what's Krishna's regard for his external energy? It's the same as a living entity who becomes attached to Krishna becomes detached from the external energy. Krishna's detached from it. He's not trying to be the enjoyer of his external energy, but he is the enjoyer of his internal energy, because the external energy is a reflection only of his internal energy, and Krishna is not deluded. It's a reflection. It's his inferior energy, and Krishna is the enjoyer of his spiritual energy. Prabhupada writes, the Lord is never... The Lord is never detached from the association of para shakti. No. Krishna is not detached from Radharani. He's not detached from his own pleasure potency. He's not attached either. It's his own pleasure potency. But he's not detached from his spiritual potency. The Parashakti and her manifestations are described in Sri Brahma Samhita 5.37. What's that verse? Ananda Chinmaya Rasa Pratibhavitavi. Ananda Chinmaya. That's a spiritual potency. Ananda Chinmaya Pratibhavitavi. So, Krishna, Govinda, has his own spiritual potency. And it's fully conscious, and it's full of bliss, and it's eternally existing. And that spiritual potency is what makes up his spiritual realm, his spiritual abode. And that spiritual potency is not different than him. The spiritual abode is not different than him. He's not detached from his own potency. Although, go back to the previous verse, while residing in Dwaraka, he exhibited this feature of fully possessing Sankhya philosophy and thus having detachment and knowledge according to the Sankhya system. Detachment from material enjoyment. Well, how could, you know, by definition, what is material? By definition, material is something that's seen apart from Krishna. How, he doesn't see anything apart from himself. He's not. He's self-situated. For him, there isn't such a thing as sense gratification. It just doesn't apply. The term doesn't apply. He's satisfying the senses of Rishikesh. He is Rishikesh. So there's no sense gratification like there is for us. It's mystical, huh? It's like seemingly contradictory, but it's really wonderful. The Lord is eternally joyful and cognizant in the taste derived from such transcendental bliss. Now comes this Upanishadic thing. Negation of the variegatedness of the inferior energy does not necessitate negation of the positive transcendental bliss of the spiritual world. You know, nirguna and saguna, or what's the other opposite? Anyway, that nirguna Brahman can equally mean or indicate Krishna. Krishna has no material qualities. Krishna's form, his swarup, has no material qualities. When one hears the phrase Nirguna Brahman, the mind goes Brahma Jyoti. But Krishna's form is also Nirguna. It's without material qualities. But he has transcendental qualities, so it's also appropriate to say Saguna Brahman. They're both appropriate because he's transcendental. Gee, that sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Something doesn't have qualities has qualities, but it's something that doesn't have material qualities has all spiritual qualities. Krishna's, because that's what's in the verse. Uddhava is speaking about Krishna's form. Snigda, smita, avalokena. His snigda, his gentle glance with a sweet smile. Snigda smita avalokena vacha. His words are compared to nectar. Piyusha kalpaya. He's meditating on Krishna, who's left. But he's obviously, he's relishing. The Uddhava is relishing in his thoughts of Krishna and describing Krishna. He's relishing Krishna. He's tasting. He's tasting transcendental happiness. Although his heart is pained by a feeling of separation. And so this taste that he's having, in relation to his transcendental body, which is the residence of the goddess of fortune, he's exhibiting detachment and knowledge, as found in the Sankhya system. It's like, you know, juggling many opposites. And then, you know, just keeps, things keep going up and they don't even come down. So negation of the variegatedness of the inferior energy does not necessitate negation of the positive transcendental bliss of the spiritual world. And Krishna is an example of that exact thing. He's detached from matter, but he is deeply absorbed in his relationship with the goddess of fortune, and his transcendental body is the abode of the goddess of fortune. What's she going to do if, you know, he becomes detached from her? He doesn't. She doesn't have to worry about that. And if there's Leela, where Krishna leaves the rasa dance, or there's Leela where Radha leaves the rasa dance, or Radha leaves Krishna's side and becomes angry, it's Leela. Although it looks like, you know, the girl's playing hard to get. You have that phrase in India. She's like being very coy and very cunning. The girl is watching out of the corner of her eye to make sure that the boy that she's showing her anger towards is paying attention to her. Playing hard to catch is our vernacular here. So, it's, you know, Radha's not doing that. She's not like flirting with Krishna and teasing. It's a loving exchange. In the material world, it's a perverted reflection of the spiritual world, which is, it's a loving exchange. There's a book by Jiva Goswami called Madhava Utsav, and part of it is Radharani is being crowned Queen of Vrindavan. That's like the theme. But in the course of the theme, there's so many intrigues. I won't go into the detail, but Krishna is, it begins with Krishna is supposed to meet Radha. Vrinda Devi makes an arrangement. First thing in the morning, sends one of her messengers. And there is an arrangement has been made for you to meet with Radha. Please come. Here's the time, here's the place. So in the course of Krishna coming to meet Radha, Chandravali, one of the messengers of Chandravali, intercepts Krishna, and there's some conversation between Krishna and Chandravali. And it's a very enigmatic, it's a very, like, you can take it this way, you can take it that way, conversation. And then Krishna's late. So one of the messengers of Radha goes to find where's Krishna. And she meets one of the messengers of Chandravali, and in a haughty way, the messenger of Chandravali says, oh, well, your Radharani is just going to have to wait, because Krishna is with Chandravali. She'll just have to wait. So the messenger goes back to Radha, doesn't even want to say anything. She tells Vishakha and Lalita, and Radha overhears, and when Radha hears, she storms out of the place that she was to be the meeting place for Krishna. And she's angry. And then Krishna comes. And they are so angry at Krishna. Get out of here! At once! Oh, what did I do? What did I do? We don't even want to talk to you. Get out of here. But, you know, let me see Radha. Leave at once. Because, you know, they're Radha's dear associates. And then Krishna breaks down and becomes terribly disturbed at the separation of Radha, and Purnamasi comes, and Purnamasi sees, whoa, look at Krishna's in this terrible, distressful state. What happened? She finds out from the gopis, and Radha's gone, and we don't even know where she is, and we're afraid she might give up her life, and so they go searching for Radha. I mean, I'm skipping lots of details, but this kind of gives you a thread of the plot. And Purnamasi, who is Yogamaya personified, finds the house, little cottage, and inside the house is Radha talking to herself, saying, why do I do like this? Something just overcomes me, and he's my dear beloved. I know he's with Chandravali and all these other things, but I can't live for a moment without him. Why do I become angry? Like, he can do what he likes. It's okay. But I have these fits and become so angry, and I don't understand myself. I become overwhelmed and crying and crying. And Purnamasi's listening. And she comes in and just embraces Radha and says, please give up this mood of yours. Your life and soul is nearly giving up his life. Rescue him. Save his life. Come with me at once. We'll make everything okay again. Please come. So she comes back. Anyway, the mood of Radha being separate from Krishna, or Krishna being separate from Radha, it's a lila. In one sense, it's yoga maya acting in such a way that the divine couple becomes separated, but they can't be separated. It's like Sita and Ram. How can Sita be kidnapped by Ravan? Not possible. Thinking that it was possible, one South Indian Ram Bhakta decided to fast until death because Sita's been kidnapped by Ravan. How can I live? And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu assured him, no, it's not possible. I promise you it's not possible. Sita cannot be touched by a despicable personality like Ravan. I assure you, a Maya Sita only was taken. No, stop your fasting. I'm going to stay here until you break your fast. So the Brahmin relented and broke his fast. And Mahaprabhu in his travels came across Kurma Purana, where it says specifically Agni came forward and produced a Maya Sita and took Sita away to protect her from the hands of Ravan. It was Maya Sita that was taken. And then when Sita entered into the fire, Agni produced the real Sita, and Maya Sita entered the fire. But even after that, the banishment of Sita, on the pretext of what? That some village person was saying bad things. So he banished Sita to the hermitage of Valmiki when she was pregnant. I mean, horrible. Horrible. What is it? It's Leela. All of those types of pastimes. So, in Dwarka, he's the husband of the goddess of fortune. His transcendental body, mind you, transcendental body, not a body of material elements, but his transcendental body is the abode of the goddess of fortune, who he's experiencing great happiness with his glances and his sweet smile and his transcendental form charming all the residents of Dwarka. His nectarian words, Piyusha Kavataya Vacha, his words are compared to nectar. And his flawless character. Therefore, the Lord's gentleness, his smile, his character, and everything related to him are all transcendental. Such manifestations of the internal potency are reality, of which the material shadow is only a temporary representation from which everyone with proper knowledge must be detached, including Krishna. Not like Krishna doesn't have any musts, but he is detached, and those who become attached to Krishna become similarly detached. The state of illusion is where one thinks illusion is reality and reality is illusion. Like, knowledge in the mode of ignorance. It's a contradiction. Knowledge and the mode of ignorance is accepting that which is to be done as that which is not to be done, and that which is not to be done as that which is to be done. Or one who accepts illusion as reality and reality as illusion. Now, how is that person supposed to be happy? And how is that person supposed to be detached? They're detached from reality and attached to illusion. What's the chance of happiness? And appreciating Krishna would have us appreciating that he was fixed as a yogi is fixed in Samkhya philosophy, detached from matter and filled with knowledge, at the same time enjoying his transcendental happiness in the association of the expansions of the goddess of fortune, his queens, in Dwarka. That makes it look like, you know, and scholars even say, what a lusty man. 16,000 queens. 16,000. And you're worshiping this person? Not only that. Yada, yada, yada. Not having any understanding of the transcendental nature of Krishna. I just had this exchange with someone who was coming to our one of our temples, I won't give the name of the place, and they come from a Greek Orthodox background. And, you know, that means strict adherence to biblical teachings that say the commandments, there's 10 commandments in Christianity, or, you know, in the Old Testament, so it's Judaism also. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Ooh. And now here we're worshiping Krishna who looks like he's committing adultery. So, how does this work? If she wanted an explanation. She wasn't put off by it. She understood, she accepted there must be some explanation. But some people, so the explanation was very satisfying. Krishna's own internal potency. He's not enjoying some other man's wife, or with some other man's wife. It's his own potency. You know, anyone else, that potency is Krishna's potency. Here's a little Prabhupada story. Rabindra Sarupabhu, I've heard him describe this several times. When Rabindra was very new in Krishna consciousness, he was in a PhD program at the University of, it's either University of Pennsylvania or Temple University, downtown Philadelphia. And then he read his Upanishad. Because it was a philosophy major. Anyway, he was like head spinning with all these different philosophies. But when he read Ishi Upanishad, it made so much sense. Like a, you know, really transcendental, clear philosophy. So then he wanted to find out who the author was, and he met Prabhupada. So Prabhupada visited Philadelphia, and Rabindra invited his PhD professor for his doctorate program to meet Prabhupada, because he knew that Prabhupada would sometimes like meet with scholars and, you know, different VIPs to try to help them become Krishna conscious. So as soon as the conversation began, Rabindra's professor said, how can you worship such a debauch who enjoys the wives of other men? And Rabindra said, he'd be like, oh no, I bring my professor and the first thing he does is insults Prabhupada. I've made a big offense to my spiritual master. This is terrible. That was like his, you know, his heart, thunderbolt hit his heart. But Prabhupada, without a moment's hesitation, said, Krishna is not the debauch, you are. And the man said, what do you mean? I only associate with my wife. And Prabhupada, without a moment's hesitation, said, and where has that wife come from? This is Krishna's energy, and you're trying to be the enjoyer of Krishna's energy. You are the enjoyer. She's Krishna's wife, and you are trying to be the enjoyer. You are the debauch. And then Rabindra, and you don't know what the rest of the discussion was, because Rabindra said, when Prabhupada was speaking like that, it wasn't just he was speaking to the professor, he was also speaking about himself. Because Rabindra said, well, I'm married and I love my wife, and you know, I'm not with any other women than my wife, and you know, we follow all the religious codes and standards, and you know, if he's a debauch, then I am too, but you know, because you know, Prabhupada said it, so how do I process this? He took it very seriously and very personally. He said he couldn't sleep that night. Not only this man insulted Prabhupada, but Prabhupada is saying that he's a debauch, and that meant that Rabindra was too. Then he said, you know, it wasn't until the sun came up that finally he was like tossing and turning and couldn't sleep, and then it occurred to him that the real issue is that we have an issue with Krishna. We have a relationship problem with Krishna. We don't want to acknowledge that everything is the property of Krishna. Krishna is the enjoyer. Religiously, one may have a duly sanctified marriage, husband and wife. But even in that duly sanctified marriage, husband and wife, it's not she's my property or he's my property. This is Krishna's part and parcel living entity. It's she and he are Krishna's property to be enjoyed by Krishna. And I have some service on behalf of Krishna. And that's the consciousness that one should be in. Not, it's this other. Krishna's the enjoyer of many wives. Krishna's the enjoyer of his own energy. If we want to enjoy something, it goes like this. If we want to enjoy something, we need something outside of ourselves. We need something to eat or something to drink, something to see and something to hear. Another person, we need some companionship, something outside of ourselves. But Krishna doesn't need anything outside of himself. When he's associating with the queens in Dwarka, which is the subject of this verse, they're the goddess of fortune. They're expansions of the goddess of fortune. And he's the husband of the goddess of fortune. They're his internal potency. There's nothing immoral at all. Conversely, what we do could be thought of, at least, you know, religiously it's not immoral, but otherwise, you know, trying to be the enjoyer of God's property, it's immoral. And thus, our consciousness is, this is Krishna's part and parcel, meant to be enjoyed by him, and how can I render service in such a way that Krishna can be pleased? Not, and that means how Krishna's senses can be pleased, not how my senses can be pleased. I like this, I don't like that. The realm of sense gratification is noticeably absent in the spiritual world and in Krishna's activities. And because he's supremely pure like that, all those who come in contact with him also become pure. So similarly, the whole of the Sankhya philosophy, the previous verse, is to come by analytical approach to the distinction between matter and spirit and develop affinity for spirit, become attached to Krishna through devotional service by making a proper distinction between matter and spirit. Okay, so we'll continue tomorrow with Uddhava's nice teachings or remembrances of Krishna. Any comments or questions? Yes?
So the Lord's attachment to the living entity, right? His marginal potential.
How is he, what?
How is his attachment to the living
entity? What does he say in Bhagavad Gita? Samoham sarvabhuteshu name dveshos tina priyaha. That's an exhibition of his neutrality. At the same time, those yome bhaktya prayachati, those who approach him with love, he reciprocates. He feels love. So it looks like, you know, for those that approach him in an inimical mood, he doesn't love. He does love. He's just reciprocating with their mood. So in one sense he's neutral or detached, but in another sense, because they're conscious, no, matter is not conscious. So what does Krishna care about, you know, the rug or the floor or other than it's his energy? But the living entity is conscious. And according to the consciousness, the regard the living entity has towards the Supreme, he reciprocates. Their mood, their disposition, their regard for him. Anything else?
By San, people who follow the process of Sankhya Yoga, they, by understanding the difference between matter and spirit, they come to the understanding that they should approach the Lord with.
At least they have the tools. They may or may not. With knowledge comes detachment. But, you know, some persons don't have complete knowledge, and so they think that the realm of spirit is just a definition by negation, and so they don't actually become attached to Krishna. There's an impersonal Sankhya, as there is a personal Sankhya. And they misapply the tools that they've gained. There's apparent contradictions in the Supreme Lord. Because he's absolute, there's resolution in those apparent contradictions. So, you were going to say?
So how do we understand Lord, we should understand Lord?
In devotion. Meaning, not by empiric evaluation. The mood is the Upanishadic language is contradiction. Like in Ishapanishad, he walks and he does not walk. He's very near and he's very far away as well. He's within everything and he's outside of everything. How do you deal with that? If you're an impersonalist, you say, just see. He has no qualities. Or it's not even he, it's it. because they can't fathom the contradictions. So, impersonal. But the, what we just read in this purport is, without having material, negation of the material is not negation of the spiritual. He can walk, but he doesn't walk like us. Doesn't require physical activity. And he can still walk, because he has a spiritual form. There's no physical activity or exertion involved. He's very far away, but he's very near as well. For the person in material consciousness, there's no way they can possibly reach him. But he's within their heart. Like near, even nearer than anything is. He's within the heart of the soul. Within the heart of hearts. But he's very far away. Etc. How is this to be understood by devotion? Not by mental adjustment, by devotion. Anything else? Continue tomorrow morning. Thank you very much. See you both, Pooja.